Welcome to the Georgia Today podcast. Here, we bring you the latest reports from the GPB newsroom. On today's episode, a program that provides free HIV home testing kits nationwide has its funding restored. The superintendent of Georgia's DeKalb County School District has been indicted on federal charges. And does AI belong in healthcare?
People need to be aware that the FDA regulates AI technology. Right now, I believe there's about 1,250 tools that are FDA approved. And those can make a diagnosis on their own.
Today is Friday, October 10th. I'm Peter Biello, and this is Georgia Today. Funding for an Atlanta-based program that has provided nearly 1 million free HIV home testing kits nationwide has been restored, allowing it to continue for another year. Together Take Me Home, based at Emory University, now has $10 million in funding for another year. The program delivers the tests through an easy-to-use website and integration with dating apps. The program is funded by the CDC. Funding cuts had been announced earlier this year. The project's executive director says that decision now has been reversed. The $10 million in funding is $2 million more than the prior year. Together Take Me Home is funded through an HIV fighting initiative launched by President Donald Trump during his first term. It steers resources to areas with the highest rates of HIV, including DeKalb, Cobb, Gwinnett, and Fulton counties, which have the highest rates of new cases among states. Artificial intelligence is transforming entire sectors of the American economy, but not without some criticism. In healthcare especially, the technology has raised concerns, from helping with medical diagnoses and the discovery of new drugs to analyzing patient data and reducing costs. AI in healthcare comes with potential benefits and risks. The Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University last month named an eminent scholar to address some of these issues. Dr. Jeffrey Talbert is the college's inaugural chair of the Department of AI and Health. He recently spoke with GPB's Orlando Montoya.
Dr. Talbert, congratulations on your appointment, and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Really excited to talk to you about AI today.
Now, I think most people now are familiar with AI, whether through online searches, shopping suggestions, and even some content creation. But in healthcare, they might not know it's being used. So how is AI being used in healthcare right now that patients might not even notice?
Yeah, you know, AI goes back a lot of years in healthcare. There's some tools that have been around for 20 years now that in the ICU that basically is a risk score that tells the physicians what's your risk that you're going to die in the next, 72 hours or 24 hours or whatever it happens to be. We've been using those for a long time, right? I think what we're seeing the explosion around is all the generative AI things where the chatbots are here, et cetera, that people are excited about. And so some of the things that really right now, if we look at the research, where the most advance is happening in AI, it's around medical imaging. So breast cancer screening, there's tools that can do mammography, and they can do it and see things that human beings can't see. And some of those tools are rating really well compared to how humans perform. Same thing for lung cancer screening, nodules on the lungs. There's tools that can do this, as well as other cancer screenings and other imaging things that do with radiology, MRIs, ultrasound, things like that. So that's where AI really is doing the best right now.
Are there also administrative tasks or administrative intelligence that the computers can be used for to save costs, for instance?
Absolutely. There's a lot of administrative things, and there's different kinds of AI that can be used for that. So if you think of, like, scheduling, how does a hospital know how many people to schedule in the emergency department at all hours of the day? AI can look at massive amounts of data and look at other things, too, the weather, sporting events, and other things that might help them understand when patients might come to the emergency department to help them schedule things better.
Now, we know that AI systems can be wrong. They can be biased. I mean, you ask AI a question sometimes, and the answer can come back goofy, or it can come back just flat out wrong and dangerous. How do you address trust in AI when people experience bias and error in it?
So I think we need to understand where the bias and the error comes from. And so the first part is I would say that we'd have to have transparency in AI. So if someone's using AI for your healthcare, you need to know that. And they need to tell you that and be upfront about it. But where the bias comes from is AI works by we train models. And the models are trained based on data. Where do we get data? We get data from historical data sources. So if I look at all of the patients that come into a hospital over the last 5 years and generate a model to do a prediction for, let's say, recognizing a cancer or doing a trajectory for someone with substance use disorder, that's based on the data that's in there. If the patients that are coming to that facility are all from one race, they're all from one area, the model, it does really well at predicting those types of patients. If a patient is from a different area and not from that particular race or that region or that income level, the model won't do as well. And so that's where you get bias. So if you train a model with the data, it's really good for the data that it was trained on, not good at other data it's not trained on.
Should patients trust that their doctors are completely making the decisions when they come through AI?
I think it depends on what you're talking about when decisions come through AI. There are very few decisions that will come through AI at this point. The ones that are available right now are the ones around the imaging models that I told you about. So there's people need to be aware that the FDA regulates AI technology. Right now, I believe there's about 1,250 tools that are FDA approved, and those can make a diagnosis on their own. There's still going to be a radiologist or a pathologist look at that same image and confirm that the AI did it correctly. Sometimes the AI can make a mistake where the doctor intervenes. Sometimes the AI can see things the doctor didn't see. I would also encourage people not to think that AI is going to replace their doctor. I like to think about it as augmented intelligence, right? It's not replacing people. It's augmenting what they can do, and it can help them do it quicker.
I'd like to share a personal experience, if I could, related to another criticism of AI in healthcare. A few weeks ago, I had to visit urgent care, and I chose this particular urgent care office because it appeared to be affiliated with the medical system that I go to for all my other care. But when I got there, I found out that it was not, despite the name out front, the same company. And I had to spend like 15 minutes like filling in all my information again, everything from my address and phone number to my mother's cause of death and insurance and all that. And if the healthcare system can't even integrate basic data like that, how can they integrate AI into their complex operations?
That's a great question. It's embarrassing that exists, but it does. And so I think one of the biggest challenges in healthcare is data interoperability. I mean, you hit it right on the head. And so there are some cases where we have the same electronic health record system. Let's say Epic, for example. Epic's in a lot of hospitals. You would think even if you go to multiple Epic hospitals that all your data would be in there. That may or may not be true, right? So even under the best circumstances, your data may not be in there. The data interoperability for AI is even more complicated than that because it's not just fields like your name and address and billing information. We're talking about if we're comparing imaging data from a radiology or from a CT scanner or from an MRI machine, it depends on what kind of machine that was, on how compatible it is with a different machine. And so part of our challenge as researchers in dealing with AI is I get a pile of images that say, 50,000 images that are all the same image of a particular type of tumor. I've got to standardize those images somehow to make sure that they're all formatted correctly and the same so that the computer can understand the difference in the image itself, not the image, the way it was generated.
We're talking about vast amounts of data here, personal data, and we know of data breaches. So how can we be assured that when this vast amount of data goes up to the AI brain to learn that it's not going to be used incorrectly?
Yeah, so that also a great question. So there's some HIPAA rules, and HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability Act, which really concerns the data security and when we're allowed to use patients' data for research. And so right now, the way that we avoid data breaches is we de-identify your data. So if we have a data set like your visit you went to the doctor recently for, that could be used to train a model with, but it wouldn't have any of your personal information in there. If it's just the raw data left over after we remove those things, then there's no risk of a data breach because there's no probability that it can ever get back to identify you.
And I know MCG is a research college as well. So
it is.
What kind of research did you want to do?
I've got my personal research that is involved with substance use disorder. And so we developed a project in Kentucky where I was before, which basically takes data from about 100 different sources at the community level, and we predict when there's going to be an opioid overdose. And we can do this with about 3 to 4 months ahead of time. And so we're able to then alert our public health partners on these projects so they can intervene in those areas if they can by distributing more naloxone, which is a life-saving medication for opioid overdoses, to try to actually prevent some of the overdoses from happening if we can identify where they're at risk. And so one of my goals is to try to bring a version of that project to Georgia so that we can, again, improve health outcomes in different areas.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Talbert is the inaugural chair of the Department of AI and Health at the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Talbert spoke with GPB's Orlando Montoya. The superintendent of Georgia's DeKalb County School District has been indicted on federal charges alleging he ran a kickback scheme in suburban Chicago. GPB's Chase McGee reports.
Devon Horton was indicted Wednesday in Chicago on 17 counts of wire fraud, embezzlement, and tax evasion. Three other people were also charged in the case. Prosecutors allege Horton issued over $280,000 in contracts to friends when he was previously superintendent of the Evanston-Skokie School District. Horton is alleged to have received more than $80,000 in kickbacks and used money from Evanston-Skokie for personal expenses. The DeKalb County School Board held an emergency meeting Thursday and suspended Horton with pay. The district says its operations will, quote, continue as normal. Horton's lawyer says he is eager to address the case in court. For GPB News, I'm Chase McGee.
Federal health agencies are warning against the use of acetaminophen during pregnancy. They say using the drug, sold under the brand name Tylenol, is linked to autism. Medical providers in Georgia are dealing with the fallout of these statements, which they say have left their patients confused and concerned. GPB's Sophie Gratis has more.
A few days before federal health agencies claimed acetaminophen could cause autism in babies, Atlanta-based obstetrician and gynecologist Dawn Mandeville sent out a notice to her pregnant patients.
And we felt like we needed to get ahead of this.
Her practice assured patients that the medication is safe, and trusted medical organizations concur. But claims made by federal health officials have left more of Mandeville's patients worried that treating pain or a fever could hurt their baby.
We are fighting an uphill battle to convince them to say, here, these are your options.
Pediatrician Kiana Washington says parents at her Metro Atlanta practice are equally hesitant.
We have recently gotten questions from parents about my child has autism and now they have a fever. And what do I do?
She's spending more time talking through their concerns.
I've offered telemedicine visits and those have actually been helpful. We can talk through how you navigate and figure out what is actually true.
For now, both providers are telling patients to avoid advice from self-titled experts online and be cautious of believing blanket statements about what might cause or treat autism. For GPB News, I'm Sophie Gratis in Atlanta.
Dozens of Atlanta parents and their children are parking their cars and grabbing a bike helmet during National Walk and Roll to School Week. GPB's Amanda Andrews has more from riders joining what they're calling the bike bus.
At Burgess Elementary, the bike rack is overflowing from all the students riding to school. They're pedaling predetermined routes in groups led by parents called the bike bus. The Atlanta Department of Transportation's Safe Routes to School program is encouraging more students to walk or bike. April Stammel and her daughter joined the bike bus in 2022. She says they haven't driven to school this year.
But so many more kids are doing it now, and it just means that it's safer and it's more fun and something the kids look forward to on Friday mornings, even when it's a little chilly.
The bike bus is scheduled to take place every Friday through the end of the school year. For GPB News, I'm Amanda Andrews.
This is All Things Considered on GPB. I'm Peter Biello. Alan Caldwell's collection of poetry, The Only Verse, captures little moments where grief rears its head, where the present moment in all its beauty clashes with awful memories, when the realization hits that love has endured in spite of tremendous obstacles. Alan Caldwell is with me now to talk about his book. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So these are mostly autobiographical poems, right?
Right, very much so.
Well, I wanted to ask about your childhood to start, because there are some poems that hint at a childhood that could have been difficult in some ways. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and how it manifests in this
book?
Well,
I mean, people say that they know monster. My father was a monster by any definition monster. And I knew part of it growing up. And if you live in that kind of situation with that kind of person that has, you know, I think he was rapid cycling bipolar. And I think he was, you know, a lot of things I don't know how to classify. And I think you live in a constant state of PTSD because it was constant conflict and constant verbal and sometimes physical abuse at me and my mother. So that's certainly a factor in the book. He shows up. When I wrote the first book that I wrote, he sort of appears in my essays and then in my short stories as I move along. I thought maybe I was done with him, but when I started writing the poems, I found out he still had to be talked about.
What was left to say about him in this book that you felt was necessary to put in verse?
I think I need to point out to other people that have a similar experience, that effect never goes away. I mean, you can have a wonderful life and have the best wife in the world and have a great son and daughter-in-law and two great grandkids, and you'll be dealing with life, and that, and then you'll realize that'll come up again, and that, that you'll realize that that it wasn't as buried as you thought it was, and maybe it shouldn't be.
Yeah. So, to what extent does writing about it help you deal with it?
I mean, you know the old saying, and I think it was C.S. Lewis said that we read to know we're not alone. Well, I think even more so, we write to know we're not alone. I had the poetry group up in Carrollton, Georgia, the Cultural Arts Center, and we have a lot of great poets here, very talented people, and they'll come and they'll tell their story, and doing so is de facto therapy.
Mm-hmm. So when you're revising a poem, with the understanding that writing the first draft at least can sometimes be therapeutic, what do you look for to make sure that a poem is not simply a work of therapy for you, but also something for an audience?
Well, I mean, I think you talk about universals. You make references to things universals that people understand. You don't talk about, I try to mix, you know, a personal story that I have and maybe a metaphor that is something that I remember. It might be something that I remember from my childhood, and then try to make that universal. It's difficult to do.
Well, I'll put you on the spot here and pause if you need to think about it. But right. Is there an example of what you just described in this book that really stands out to you, an example of reaching for the universal?
It's called Running for No Reason. And it talks a little bit about, I was in the hospital for depression in 2012, and it talks about that. And I know a lot of people have had a similar experience. And like I say, I've lost four kids, including two of my absolute favorites to suicide. So, I mean, I write about that in here and then try to point out, you know, some things that help me to sort of hold on to. So.
Well, I love this poem. So would you read it for us?
I would. I'll try to read slowly. It's called Running for No Reason. He sprints just ahead of me, gleeful heart and head, shuffling through the early yellow poplar leaves as fast as his preschool legs can take him. Catch me, Papa, he says. Pursued by no one, he runs for reasons I can't name. I can only dream of running for no reason, but I tell myself I could catch him if I had to. Maybe this fall I can. I can't speak for future falls and pursuits. Autumn here comes and goes, and is more often hot than not. Maybe the poplars submit to drought, or to the ever-shortening days, or maybe they simply tire from holding on so long. 12 years ago, this October, I too grew tired, my feet like lead, my lips wrapped around a revolver, my brain aching like a rotten tooth. I can't say with any certainty that I'll never be there again, not holding on to my leaves, not even wanting to. But this October, my feet are heavy, but not lead. My revolver is put away. My aches are dull and distant, and I dream of running for no reason.
I was struck by the shift in the middle of that poem where you go from a scene with your grandson running to a revolver. We can't see it listening to this conversation, but the shift stands alone on a line and kind of shocks you.
Right.
At least it shocked me.
Right.
Is that what you were going for?
I remember the exact instance this happened. There's a little small field by my house, and I was on one end of it, and Asher, my grandson, was running towards the other end of it. And I'm like, oh, I got to come back. It's hard to catch him. He's really fast. And I thought about juxtapositioning that moment with the moment I remember when I didn't think I would ever have that to hope for. And so I wanted that to pop up.
Well, Alan Caldwell, thank you for laying yourself bare in this book. It's called The Only Verse. Thank you so much for speaking with me about it.
Thank you for having me on.
Alan Caldwell's book is called The Only Verse, and it's the subject of our latest episode of Narrative Edge, GPB's podcast about books with Georgia connections. Find Narrative Edge wherever you get your podcasts.
A toxic fire, a plume of smoke, and a community demanding answers. In Conyers, Georgia, the biolab disaster left residents searching for truth and accountability. This season, GPB uncovers system failures, hears from whistleblowers, and follows neighbors still fighting to be heard. I'm Pamela Kirkland. Join me for season 2 of Manufacturing Danger, the Biolab Story. Listen now at gpb.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
And finally, the Savannah Bananas unveiled their 2026 tour schedule last night during a live city selection show broadcast on ESPN2, ESPN+, Disney+, and YouTube. Team founder Jesse Cole said Banana Ball drew more than 2 million fans this year, and he hopes to grow that number to 3 million in 2026. Banana Ball will be played in 14 major league parks, including a 3-day stand at Truist Park in Atlanta. Additionally, last night featured the announcement of two new teams to the Banana Ball lineup, the Loco Beach Coconuts, and, with a special presentation from the president of the Negro League Baseball Museum, the Indianapolis Clowns.
One of the most influential teams in history came out of the Negro Leagues in the 1930s. They were the first to combine high-level play with dazzling entertainment. You couldn't take your eyes off the field. They had a fans-first mentality long before anyone else. But they were also getting some great talent.
Where did you learn to handle a ball like that?
In 1952, they were the first to sign an 18-year-old future Hall of Famer, Henry Hank Aaron. One of their stars, Gooch Taylor, also played for the Harlem Globetrotters. The first female pro players joined the team. Even Satchel Paige pitched for them. This is what made them so special, that combination of entertainment and great baseball. The team was good enough to win four titles in the 1950s. They had no idea that they were making history. You see, they just wanted to play ball. They played games in Canada, Cuba, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. 41,000 saw them put on a show in Detroit. They were the last surviving Negro League team. Then in 1989, they disappeared.
Please welcome to the stage the president of the Negro League Baseball Museum, Mr. Bob Tuntrell!
And now they are back. I am proud to introduce the newest banana ball team, the Indianapolis Clowns!
And that is a wrap on Georgia Today. Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate you choosing us to help you stay informed. If you want to learn more about any of these stories, check out our website, gpb.org/news. And remember to subscribe to this podcast because we're going to be back next week with all the latest headlines. If you've got feedback, we'd love to hear from you. The best way to send your feedback is by email. The address is georgiatoday@gpb.org. When you send an email to that address, it comes to the whole team. Again, georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thanks again for listening, and have a great weekend.